History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we've discovered is they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions and then invest enough time to listen patiently as memories, sometimes buried for decades, start to take on new meaning in the here and now. Our aim, of course, is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The World War II veteran we have the privilege of getting to know today has been on quite a journey over the last 96 years. How many nonagenarians do you know who drive themselves 15 miles each way to work every weekday? What that work happens to be is pretty fascinating, too, and we'll get to all of that eventually with Herbert Ford of Exeter, California, a veteran of the Merchant Marine, the Army Air Corps, and ultimately the U.S. Air Force, who also happens to be a prolific author still working on multiple manuscripts. A good portion of his professional life orbits around a tiny island in the Pacific with some pretty noteworthy history. But Mr. Ford's history starts out in the Lone Star State. I know you were an only child, but what do you remember about those early years?
Well, I think growing up in Texas, you're always talking about football. And the big thing in Texas in those days for a young fellow growing up was he's going to make his way to the University of Texas Longhorns or to Texas A&M, the Aggies, and those were big things. We had lots of contact with Spanish-speaking people there in South Texas because we were right on the border, and it was a joy to meet with them. We always felt that Spanish-speaking people in that part of America were great people.
How big was your hometown?
The population of San Benito, where I was born, was about 3,000. And then I grew up in the nearby town of Harlingen, Texas, and that would have been about 12,000 people, not large cities.
Do you remember as a young boy having some ambitions, some hopes, some dreams, some thoughts, hey, someday this is what I'm going to do with my life?
I always wanted to be in the petroleum industry because in that part of Texas, a lot of oil wells were drilled, and I saw the big, splendid cars that the oil executives would travel around in. And I decided that I wanted to own some oil wells and live high on the world. But that just didn't occur.
And most of us around today didn't live through the Great Depression, but you were a boy during those years. Did your family feel the effects of that at all?
Well, yes, they did. Of course, I was born in 1927. We lived very, very simply. It was a scratch type of life. My mother, I grew up in a single family home, or a single person home, just my mother. And she had to work terribly hard hours to make enough money to live on. She would start in the morning at about 4 o'clock, making 80 pies for a cafeteria and delicatessen in the town of Harlingen. She, of course, paid for my education. She wanted me to be in a Christian school. So that was a part of the difficulty of growing up in those days. Money was very, very scarce. People simply had to do without.
I know a good portion of your 96 years have been spent working on this topic of Pitcairn Island, and we're going to talk more about that. But when did that idea, that fascinating legend, if you will, first kind of captivate your mind?
Yes, well, the mutiny on the Bounty, a famous British naval incident, brought Pitcairn into national light and international light, because the mutineering sailors went to Pitcairn Island to hide away from the British that were looking for them. But I was about 7 years old when I first heard the names of Pitcairn in mission stories that would be told in the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Harlingen, Texas. The story fascinated me, and I just could never get it out of my mind.
And we're going to get some real evidence of that here in a little while. I don't want to gloss over anything, but there seems to be everyone I've encountered that was alive then has some kind of memory about December 7th, 1941, and the attack on Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you found out about that or where you were?
Yes, I remember quite specifically. I was in my family home. The address was 1018 West Grant Street in Harlingen, Texas. And it was in the early afternoon. And for some reason, the family radio was on. And I listened in wonderment, because I was still a young person, to the idea that airplanes had dropped bombs on Hawaii. At that time, Hawaii just didn't seem to be anywhere in the world as far as I was concerned. But I could tell from the look on my mother's face and a couple of other people that were in the room that this was a very serious matter. And that was the afternoon of December 7, 1941.
And did you notice things changing in Harlingen after that?
Well, the change came in that young men started going away from town. Purchases were different in that people had to have stamps from a little book to buy sugar and buy other things. And of course, metal was almost impossible to get, sheet metal or anything like that, because everything began to go toward the war effort. So things changed very much. A lot of people started using bicycles to conserve gas and things like that. So it did change very much there in Harlingen.
And when did it start to become real to you that you might end up being a part of this global conflict?
Well, for a long time, it didn't seem to get to me. But in the early part of 1945, I knew I was going to be drafted into the service, even though the war had continued and was seeming to be won. But I saw a poster one day, and it said that Uncle Sam needed you, and then applied to me. And so I decided that I would join the United States Merchant Marine, or the maritime service of the country. Went to San Francisco and signed up, and was assigned to what's called a T2 tanker, which is a large tanker ship, carried 141,000 barrels of fuel oil for other ships. And we sailed from San Pedro, California into the Pacific Ocean, went down to Ulithi in the Caroline Islands of the Pacific, had no orders to discharge any of our cargo there, and were reassigned to the Philippines. We were there, and then reassigned from there to go up to Tokyo, Japan, with the invasion fleet that went up in 1945. And we discharged our cargo mostly on a real huge white hospital ship with the Red Cross painted on the side, and the remainder of our fuel was discharged onto a Navy tanker called the Tule Canyon. Then we turned around and headed back for the United States, arrived back in San Pedro November 24 of 1945, and then I got a notice from my draft board that if I was not back on my ship on December 25, that I would be immediately drafted. I didn't like the idea of being drafted as a ground pounder and into the Army, and so I went to Brownsville, Texas, and signed up with the United States Army Air Corps, and from there was assigned basic training up on the Red River in North Texas. The moment I was done with my basic training. I was assigned to the Pentagon building in Washington, D.C., and served almost the entirety of my three-year hitch in the Air Force at that time. During that period of time, the name was changed from the United States Army Air Corps to the United States Air Force. So I got out of the service on December 31, 1948, and began to be a student at a college in Northern California.
And I have a few follow-up questions there, because I know some of this may not seem like a big deal to you, especially all these years later, but as I try to put myself in your shoes, you're a 17-year-old in the Pacific on a ship that's full of fuel. You have to be thinking there's submarines out there, something could go wrong. What were your realistic expectations at the time?
Well, I guess I'm too naive. I wasn't very worried about it, although we, of course, had a big gun on the bow of our ship, a 4-inch 5 gun, and a Navy gun crew that was assigned to handle that gun. But we had to fill in for the Navy crew in the case they were taken out during an action. So we were always concerned about this matter, but to me, it was that there was work to be done every day and kept your mind busy. There were nice things that happened, of course. For the first time in my life, I saw a moon bow. There's the rainbow. But at night and over the oceans, at rare times, there is a bow that's constructed from the rays of the moon that are just like a rainbow in the daytime. A lot of nice memories from that service, but of course the threat was always there.
Well, yeah, and you also said something there that your ship was part of this invasion fleet. So the invasion of Japan was planned and would have happened without the atomic bombs being dropped. How did you feel about that idea? Did you really think you were going to make it back to America, or did you have your doubts?
What I had was my aspiration, and that was to aspire to get back to America. Because, frankly, my service on the ship wasn't as fantastic as I thought it should have been, you know. But it was a feeling that of immensity that just really hits you when you go into your parking place in Tokyo Bay with this invasion fleet, and I say your parking place in the water, of course, and you see row after row after row of aircraft carriers and destroyers and submarines and all kinds of military, naval ships and things like that. That force would have rendered anybody impotent, I think. It was just a huge thing, and we, of course, were not able to get to the Missouri where the actual service of surrender went on, but we, of course, had radio communication with them and had some crude type of scene that we could see what was going on.
So September 2nd, 1945, when they're on the Missouri signing the surrender, you were actually in Tokyo Bay.
That's correct. Yes, we were. We were able to get off the ship and go into town, into Yokohama, really. It was a sight you just wouldn't believe. There was hardly a building standing anywhere. It was just a flat surface of destroyed places. There were a few. One of my friends in the media, Carl Maidens, who was one of Life magazine's early photographers, was also there. He went to a place in Yokohama about the same time I was there that made lenses for cameras. And he used these Japanese lenses in his cameras before the war. And he was interned for a while and then got out and accompanied MacArthur up to Tokyo. But anyhow, Carl went and found the people who were making these lenses and told them what great lenses they made. They said to him, "Oh, Mr. Maidens, that's so wonderful, but why don't our lenses sell to the world? We want to sell to the world." He said, that's because you have Japanese markings on your lenses and you need lenses that people can understand. Oh, they said, would you make some markings for us? And they did that, he said, and ever after, if especially finely ground lens came through the line in that company, they would set it aside and send it to Carl Mydans, and it became a Mydans lens for them.
It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 96-year-old Herbert Ford of Exeter, California. More memories, not just from World War II, but from the Korean War era as well. One of his memories from his years in the Pentagon involves a legendary general and a situation Mr. Ford feared might get him court-martialed. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 96-year-old Herbert Ford of Exeter, California, originally from the Harlingen, Texas area along the border. He served in both the Merchant Marine and the U.S. Army Air Corps. When we left off, he was telling us about being aboard his ship, the SS Fort George, in Tokyo Bay while General MacArthur and Admiral Nimitz and others were signing the instruments of surrender aboard the battleship USS Missouri. I guess I should ask you, too, if you're there in Tokyo Bay September 2nd, maybe what happened a few weeks before that was significant too. Do you remember getting that news aboard ship that Japan had surrendered?
Yes, we had received that news, and it was joyful. I thought that we might be diverted from going up, but we weren't. We were assigned to go ahead into Tokyo.
And you told us that back in the States, you got the draft notice and you decided to join the Army Air Corps. Were you hoping to become a pilot?
No, I knew I would not become a pilot. I was born with strabismus, which is crossed eyes and never fully corrected. And the surgery that was done on it reduced the vision in the left eye to the point where I knew that I wouldn't qualify as a pilot. But I just liked the idea of the Air Corps rather than the Army. That was my reason.
And it doesn't seem like that strabismus has really stopped you from doing much.
Well, it hasn't, and people have been very generous about my goggly eyes. But I like to do what I like to do, and I give it all I can when I get to it.
And we're going to hear more about that. So you're in the Army Air Corps, and you told us they shipped you right to the Pentagon, which is a fairly new facility at this time. What did they have you doing there?
Yes, the Pentagon, of course, was opened in 1943, and I was assigned to the Air Adjutant General's Office, and I was assigned to take care of the records of air officers that were assigned to the Pentagon building. That included the lowest ranking officer, air officer, and the highest ranking air officer, which was the chief of staff of the Air Force. At that time, General Hoyt Vandenberg was the chief of staff. And the Pentagon experience was very interesting. We moved our offices in the Pentagon building about every 4 to 6 months. I say we moved them, the officials moved them. And we would come on a Friday morning and there would be a note on our typewriter that said, on Monday morning, you will report to such and such a place on such and such a ring of the Pentagon building, which is five-sided, as you know. You tie these two pieces of twine to the platen of your typewriter so the platen won't go back and forth while it's being transported somehow. So you report to that new place, and you would come on Monday morning, and you would find everything. You might be on the totally other side of the building, maybe another floor up or down, and everything would be exactly the same as when you left it on Friday at the other place, your original place. And even the waste baskets were placed in exactly the same place. So it was a security matter to make sure that people didn't come to know that you were there in one place permanently. And of course, the Pentagon was an interesting place with so many high-ranking officers. When we first went into the Pentagon building, I was just out of basic training, of course, and I was saluting every officer I would see because I was a lowly private. I'd get a laugh out of most of these fellas as they would throw a real quick salute back at me. And then I reported to the place where I was supposed to begin working, to a colonel, and we saluted him, I saluted him, and he started laughing. And he said, have you been saluting everybody here? We said, yes, sir. And there was another guy with me. He said, stop that. He said, we don't salute around here or we'd lose our arms. He said, there are too many. And but it was a good service. During the latter part of my hitch, I was assigned to take the medals, of the service medals that depicted where a person had served in the United States or in foreign areas, around to all of the Air Force officers in the Pentagon building. One of these, of course, was General Hoyt Vandenberg's office. Went there, and his aide-de-camp, a major, was there, and I started to give him the medals, and suddenly the general walked out of the office. And we enlisted people in the Pentagon. This was a time when the Air Force was changing their uniform from the Army Air Corps olive drab color to Air Force blue with new Air Force blue uniforms. And it was a period of a vacuum sort of, and we listed guys had started tailoring ourselves a little bit. We had stripes sewn on the back of our shirts. Instead of wearing issued belts, we wore white web belts, wore white socks, and loafer for shoes rather than these. And here the general comes out and he looks over and he sees me and he says, Sergeant, he says, is that the new Air Force uniform you're wearing? And I thought I was gonna be court-martialed, but he laughed about it very much. And those kinds of things happen infrequently, of course, but it did make service in the Pentagon building a joy and to me.
Well, I'm just imagining if you spent that much time there, there were probably some other officers or personalities of note that you rubbed elbows with.
Well, yes. One I remember very much because for some reason he liked to stop by and just chat for a while. Captain Gentile, his name was. He was a leading air ace in Europe for quite a while. He was credited with destroying 26 German airplanes in dogfights. And Don just seemed to like to talk, and I sure liked to listen to him. But there were a number of people that we had good relationships with there.
And did that give you, I'm curious what kind of perspective that proximity to power gave you, to be there in the Pentagon where so many of these big decisions are being made, what kind of perspective did that give you?
Well, that kind of puffed your ego up a little bit, I think, you know. I really, really enjoyed the service so much there because it was, though it was hard in ways, we were stationed in the Pentagon building but housed at Bowling Field, which is down in the south of Washington, D.C. And every morning early, we would eat our breakfast and be bused over to the Pentagon building from the field. Then in the evening, come back, and we would go into the mess hall in the evening, and all of the steaks and other things that were really good stuff, you know, had been used up by the other personnel on the field by that time. And so a hamburger patty and canned peaches and stuff like that was our, and we griped about it, you know, a bit. At one time, near the end of my service, the commander of the field, a brigadier general, called us all together. Those enlisted men who worked in the Pentagon building were housed on the field. And he addressed us, "You Pentagon prima donnas," he said. "You will not talk to your officers that you work for about conditions on this field or about the way you're treated or anything else. And you just straighten up." That was his whole point. 3 weeks later, we were assigned per diem to get places to live off of the field in Washington, D.C. It all came about by one of the fellows in the Pentagon disobeying the general and talking to his general, who happened to be a lieutenant general with 3 stars. And this lieutenant general had things changed for this squadron. It was called the Headquarters and Headquarters Squadron of the United States Air Force. So we were put on per diem. And it became an awful lot like a civilian job almost.
I guess I should ask you too, since you had a front row seat, the transition from the Army Air Corps to the United States Air Force, was that a significant shift in terms of how things operated?
Not at all. There was no change except that we were ordered to report for new uniforms. And we thought the Air Force blue was pretty terrific stuff.
My nephew, who's a junior at the Air Force Academy, agrees with you. And all that time around the Pentagon and in Washington, did you ever encounter President Truman?
No, I never thought about Truman very much. Only after everything was said and done, after the bombs were dropped and everything, did Truman's place in shaping the world at that time come to my sense, really. I'm a late learner, you know. But no, we had no contact with anything of a political nature in that situation at all. There at Bowling Field, they had the Bowling Field is located right on the Potomac River in the south. They had a 3 crash boats that were stationed there. In the case any aircraft, there was a naval air station right next to Bowling Field. So you had a lot of aircraft flying in and out. And the air officers assigned to the Pentagon building, who were pilots, had to do proficiency flying out of Bowling Field. So these crash boats were there on the water in the case any plane would go down. And I made friendships with a number of the fellows on the crash boats, and we used to go on Sundays and other off days, holidays more or less, along the Potomac. And along the Potomac River in Washington itself is a sidewalk right beside the river that goes along, and the park area back of that. And we used to take our crash boats and start opening them up, and the wake of our crash boat would hit the little wall that was there and go over the top of the wall, and people that were walking along on the sidewalks would be hit with water up to about the knees from this wave. And we would do a quick turn and head back down the river from doing that. But that was part of the craziness of the whole thing.
Well, that is one thing Herb Ford did not reenact on his recent visit to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. The next flight for that chapter is coming up. You can welcome veterans home in Fresno, California on October 18th. But you don't have to wait that long if you're anywhere near Santa Maria, California. And I know we have a lot of you listening out there on California's Central Coast. October 4th, Wednesday night, around 7:30 p.m., you can welcome home nearly 100 veterans from their Honor Flight to Washington, D.C. That'll be at the Santa Maria Airport Wednesday, October 4th. When we come back, Mr. Ford will explain why exercising his conscience led to one of the biggest blessings of his life. And we'll hear about his connection with World War II's most famous conscientious objector, Desmond Doss. He's the Medal of Honor recipient whose story took on new life in recent years because of the film Hacksaw Ridge, portraying his heroics in the Battle of Okinawa. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with a World War II veteran who sure doesn't seem like he's 96 years old, does he? He still drives to work 5 days a week, and the nature of that work is pretty remarkable. We may have to extend this conversation into another episode to capture all of that, but when we left off with Herb Ford, he was relating some of his memories from the late 1940s, when he was assigned to a massive building in the Washington, D.C. area that was only a few years old. He had served in the Merchant Marine and the Army Air Corps, and was stationed at the Pentagon when the transition from U.S. Army Air Corps to U.S. Air Force occurred. I know from there you went to college, but did you think at all about making the Air Force a career?
No, I didn't. I didn't. Near the end of my service, when it was known that I was coming to the end of my hitch, there were requests coming to me from three or four places that I would re-up for three more years and I would have my last rocker. I would become a master sergeant, and that's a pretty good rank to have as an enlisted person, you know. But I never thought about officer candidate school or anything like that. And then as I came rather near the end of my career, I knew that I needed some education. I was still a country bumpkin. So I decided that I was definitely going to get out and start my education.
And so Pacific Union College was the choice because of the church affiliation?
Yes, but more so because my teachers at the academy in South Texas in my high school, had several of them had been graduates of Pacific Union College. How they made their way from California to Texas, I don't know. But anyhow, they made the college sound so good that I determined that I would go there.
You know, there's an important question that I haven't asked you, because I'm thinking about, you know, your three daughters and your four grandchildren and your seven great-grandchildren. They wouldn't be here without a significant detail. Where in this whole timeline did you meet your wife?
Yes, I was stationed at Hamilton Field during the Korean War. Mm-hmm. Hamilton Field is just north of San Francisco. When I was first assigned there, I told the major who was in charge of the unit that as a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, I could not work on Saturday. And he said, Ford, he said, that's impossible. We're working 7 days a week, almost 24 hours a day, getting all these people back to active duty. And that was on a Monday. And I said, I understand that, sir, but I cannot work on Sabbath day. My conscience will not allow that. And so the major said, I don't know what we'll do. But anyhow, I was assigned as chief of the officers classification section there. On Wednesday, I saw him again. He said, I haven't worked out anything yet, Ford. But then on Friday, we were having an official organization of this unit, because this was all brand new stuff. So he puts out the assignments for the different people in the unit. And he said, Sergeant Ford will be in charge of the officers' classification section, except on Saturday when he goes to church, and Sergeant Lucich will be in charge of the unit that day. And he looks at me, he says, does that take care of it, Ford? I said, sir, that does. Yes, thank you. Anyhow, I went then to church on that Saturday, to the Berkeley Adventist Church. And there at that church was the young lady who would become my wife of the future. This went on, but I became very enamored of her best friend. And it was an enamorment, but also it was a simpatico type of thing, because that young lady's mother was dying of cancer at the time. And I, in this whole thing, became engaged, not officially engaged, but understood engaged to her. And then I was lecturing at Hamilton Field to these officers that were coming back to active duty in preparation of their records. And my throat, my tonsils became infected and everything else. And so I went into the hospital. And as I'm in the hospital, I'm thinking very, very much about this engagement and everything else. And I'm also thinking about that other young lady that was there. And I suddenly realized that really it was that other young lady that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. And so that, of course, made me become the worst person in the world to the young lady of engagement. It took me a long, long time, nearly half a year, using every device I could think of. My wife at that time was a piano student of the leading piano teacher in the greater San Francisco Bay Area, Dr. Alexander Lieberman. And she, along with one other of his students, Samuel Lippman, was scheduled to open the San Francisco Symphony with Pierre Montour, the conductor. She, of course, was a piano student at Mills College at that time. Well, anyhow, I devised ways to make myself very accomplished in classical music to try to be close to her, and that seemed to work. But things went on, and we became very much a couple, and then it was a wonderful time. And the other young lady, we kept close to her, and she had a very successful marriage while we were there, too. So it wasn't as bad as it could have been, but still I was a bad, bad boy, that's for sure.
Well, it kind of reminds me of something that I think of a lot, that God's plans are always better than our plans. And I guess if you had not exercised your conscience and held to your belief about the Sabbath, you never would have met your wife to begin with, right?
That's right. That's right. I would not. About that, I came back from having been at church on Saturday, and on Sunday morning, I came into the day room of the squadron. And the first sergeant saw me. His name was Aaron Brown. And he said, Ford, he said, where were you yesterday? And I said, I was at church. He said, are you a Seventh-day Adventist? I said, yes, I am. He said, well, I'm an Adventist too. I said, well, where were you yesterday? And he said, I couldn't get off. Nobody gets off. I said, listen. I said, talk to the major. He's a reasonable man. And he did, and we went to church together the next Saturday, which was interesting.
I don't want to make a leap that isn't there, but it kind of sounds like even a tonsil infection was a silver lining to this thing, because it gave you the time to figure out who you wanted to be with.
It surely did. That's the truth. Yeah, right.
How long were you two married?
64 and a half years. Mm-hmm. Interestingly enough, when it was known on the campus of our full engagement and everything, the dean of women in the hall that my future wife was in, she told my wife, you shouldn't marry that man. He'll never be any good for you. And my wife said, well, we'll see. And it was 64 and a half years that we were together.
And any time I have the privilege of meeting someone who can say that, I want to ask them how they did it, right? What was the secret? What advice would you have for someone else who would like their marriage to last that way?
Well, you never want to push for your way too much. And in our situation, I think our spiritual life was a bond that we enjoyed, and it was kind of a glue that held us together, too.
Well, and so we've heard how you got a taste of World War II in the Merchant Marine. You're even there in Tokyo Bay when they're signing the surrender. Then you end up in the Army Air Corps. You're there in the Pentagon as it transitions to the Air Force. But in your early career, you're doing public relations for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And you got to know a gentleman who is probably the most famous conscientious objector. We heard about your conscience and how it worked for you. Tell me about Desmond Doss. Hacksaw Ridge is a movie now that has made his name a household name even more than before. But you knew him back in the 50s?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, I once had an editor of a publishing house ask me if I wouldn't write a book about Desmond Doss, but I told him no, I couldn't, because I was working on two other books at the same time. But anyhow, on at least two occasions, I was able to place Desmond Doss on television shows. Art Linkletter show was one of them, and one was another CBS West Coast regional show. And Des and I talked quite a bit together. Being of the same faith, we kind of bonded with that too. He was a true, he sounded like a true hayseed. I mean, you know, he came out of the back country, as it were. But what a heart he had. He just was full of love for people. I don't think the Congressional Medal of Honor could have gone to any person more deserving than he, in terms of heart, as well as action of saving lives that he did on that escarpment.
Is there an element of that story? And I heard that when they made the film Hacksaw Ridge, there was part of the true story they wouldn't even put in the film because they said that's just not believable enough, right? I mean, that is there a part of his story and what he did there on Okinawa that really touches your heart or really impresses you?
Well, the fact that he would overcome fear, just set it aside, believing that he would be taken care of by his relationship with the divine. That, of course, is something not too many people attempt to harness, you know. I think his determination to get every person he could possibly get to save was an example of what the good book tells us, that heaven wants to save every person possible.
They really did capture that element of it in the film where he says over and over, help me get one more. Was there anything maybe that the film didn't have that you think we ought to know about a guy that you knew better than we did?
No, I don't think so. His wife was a graduate of Pacific Union College, which is another little tie that I take hold of. We just had these momentary times together, you know. Before the Linkletter show, I talked with him maybe for a full hour while we were waiting for the Goodell production people to get everything ready. I just came to admire the man very much.
Did you ever regret not writing that book?
No. I just write what I can and leave it to somebody else to do the other things.
And how many books have you written?
Well, I've written a dozen of them. Four of them have been about Pitcairn Island, different aspects of it. And the others have been stories of missionaries overseas and story of the underground leader, John Widener. Just books that have kind of been forced on me via my public relations work.
Believe it or not, he is still working on new books, four manuscripts in progress, in fact. And if you enjoy listening to Hometown Heroes, I know you'd love Mr. Ford's book, Flee the Captor. That tells the story of his late friend John Widener, who saved the lives not only of more than 100 Allied aviators during World War II, but more than 800 Jews as well through his work with the Dutch Paris Underground. I have that book linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, but we're going to have to save Mr. Ford's comments about that book till next week, because this hour has flown right by. We do have much more to explore. The Pitcairn Island Study Center he founded and still runs at age 96, and his recent honor flight to Washington, D.C., where the statue of the flag raising atop Iwo Jima's Mount Suribachi at the Marine Corps War Memorial held special significance to him. One of the men depicted in that statue was his classmate back in South Texas. So don't miss the rest of our conversation with Herbert Ford in our next episode, and thank you so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.